The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. Maybe I should say sitting in now that our Trumpet Daily set includes a chair. We used to have the stand-up set and standing in felt very appropriate then. Well, Mr. Flurry is traveling with the Celtic Throne group today. They're performing in Nashville tonight. And then they'll be, I believe, in Memphis on Thursday. So if you're in or around Tennessee, it's well worth taking the opportunity to go and see that. And as usual, you can look that up online. I think it was CelticThrone.com. I should have, I meant to put that in my notes. But if you Google Celtic Throne, you will be able to get all of the details you need about that spectacular show. Well, as usual, there's a lot of news to get to and go through. Over the weekend, or at least on Friday, Iran held their presidential election. Now, are you sitting on the edge of your seat waiting to find out who would have won this close contest? Well, no, you probably weren't, because the Iranian elections don't really matter. Not because Iran doesn't matter, not because they're unimportant, but because these elections don't really change anything. Far too many news outlets in the West treat the Iranian elections as if they're real elections, but they're not. There's just enough there to kind of give the very surface veneer appearance of democracy, but it's all a sham. The Iran's religious leaders get to pick who runs. Only people that meet their approval get to run. And then the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, he has the power at the end of the day anyway. If a US equivalent would see you get to choose between Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Kamala Harris, and Bernie Sanders, and at the end of the day, Barack Obama is the supreme leader and has all the power. You're sure there'd be some difference between those four, but that's a very limited choice. That kind of system is not democracy. And you see the sham in Iran by the person, I'll put person in quotes there, who came second place in the Iranian election. Second place went to invalid. There were around nearly 4 million. I saw a couple of different numbers. I think one said 3.7 million, another said 2.4 million. Millions, at least, of blank or void ballots, around 14% of the vote by one count, putting them very comfortably in second place to the inevitable winner, the hardliner Ibrahim Raisi. So second place there going to invalidated ballots. Raisi got 7.8 million votes. Even then, though, turnout was the lowest ever for an election in Iran, about 48%. And this is even after they kept extending the voting hours to try and get more people to come out and vote. Because in the past, Iran has pointed to election turnout as a means of showing how valid their elections are and boasting about how valid their elections are. So it's a little bit embarrassing for them to have record low turnouts this time. Iranian state TV all day, they were playing patriotic music and shows, encouraging people to come do their patriotic duty and go out and vote to fulfill their duty, to quote the blood, their duty for the blood of the martyrs. And the supreme leader, Khamenei, he even insinuated that a failure to vote was treason. And even after all of that, half the country didn't bother to vote. It was pretty much the only way they could protest this very one-sided election. And even though the vote doesn't matter, what happens in Iran does. This is right at the heart of some critical Bible prophecies. And even by Iran's standard, though, this was a new level of rigging. Brent Noctegal has an article on our website on this on this election. But in that article, he was quoting an Iranian expert he'd been able to hear at a press grouping, Dr. Tamar Aliyem Gindin. And she said, "This time they're not even trying to play the game. Usually everyone knows that, but they try to make it look, you know, like they're legitimate. But this time they didn't even try." So wolves in wolf's clothing fill ballot in Iranian election. That's the article from Brent on our website. The article also quotes Woham Alvandi, Associate Professor of International History at the London School of Economics. He said, "This election makes explicit what most Iranians have already known implicitly, that the Islamic Republic will not countenance any peaceful reform. That erodes what little popular legitimacy the current political system has left." And Brent in this article goes on to talk about the way that, you know, normally some pragmatists, quote unquote, or moderates, quote unquote, are allowed to make it to the ballot, ones that are still approved by the supreme leader, but they let them get onto the final ballot. And this at least allows them to present the ruse to the foreign media, as Brent puts it, that there are moderate elements inside Iran's political system. This time, there was just one guy who you could even consider a moderate, and he was kind of very little political experience, no way he was going to win. And then it was six hardliners. He wrote, "What this election means is that the Islamic regime is dispensing with the need to play the game with the West, that it is open to democratic change towards moderation. They are no longer trying to put forth candidates such as current President Hassan Rouhani to soften the image of Iran's regime." And he talked about how the Obama administration kind of used Rouhani to push this false narrative that, well, we can do business with Iran because they've got a moderate in charge. They're showing that they're willing to change. And as he points out, Rouhani didn't change the character of the Iranian regime, just the appearance. And Benjamin Netanyahu talked about the way that Rouhani was a wolf in sheep's clothing, whereas previously you had Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who was a wolf in wolf's clothing. And that's where this title for his article that he wrote, that went up on Friday before the official results of the election were announced, or before the election had even taken place, but still knew the outcome, that what we would get is a wolf in wolf's clothing this time around. They didn't even bother having a serious sheep in wolf's clothing on the ballot paper. And so in this article, Brent writes, "This highlights a big change in confidence in the image the Islamic Republic wishes to send to the world, particularly the United States. In 2013, with a nuclear deal and sanction removal on the table, the Ayatollah thought it important to present a moderate for the United States to deal with. In 2021, again with a nuclear deal and sanctions removal on the table, the Ayatollah does not feel the need to placate the West. If sanctions relief," and then he quotes someone from Al Arabiya, "if sanctions relief will be on the table, no matter who is at the helm, then Khomeini may feel safe enough to ditch the window dressing. So confident is the Ayatollah that the Biden administration will yield in nuclear negotiations that he has dispensed with the sheep's clothing altogether." And that's something that's important here. Like I said, the elections themselves may not matter, but Iran does. And you can see from this that the Biden administration is so weak that Iran doesn't even think they need to try and look moderate anymore. He writes, "Such boldness from Iran during an election cycle is new. It is the direct result of years of appeasement by the West, and particularly the United States." He quotes Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry in his article, "The Barack Obama Mystery," writing, "Iran's current emboldened state is the purposeful fruit of Obama's Middle East policy, a policy Joe Biden continues to this day." So putting someone like Rezi in charge is bold. And again, people talk too much about Rezi being elected. You know, he was chosen. Even Rouhani declared everyone knows who the winner is. And I think that he said that before the election had even happened. But it's in a bold, aggressive move. You know, Rezi, back in 1988, he was on a committee that condemned thousands of political prisoners to death. He's presided over the mass imprisonment of journalists, of political activists, of dual citizens, including America. They're not even trying to present somebody who kind of looks like someone America can do business with. It's a very bold, very pushy move to put this guy in charge. So why focus on Iran? Why open up by talking about these Iranian elections? We do talk a fair bit about Iran on our website, on our sister publication that focuses more on the Middle East, Watch Jerusalem. Well, Iran is right at the heart of several key Bible prophecies. The Bible has a critical end time prophecy in Daniel chapter 11. I'll turn here in my Bible. I think I've got the text written out here too. Daniel chapter 11 contains absolutely vital prophecy for putting end time events in context. And Daniel chapter 11 and verse 40 states, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind, with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over." So who is this mysterious king of the north, king of the south? It's a prophecy for the time of the end. It's a prophecy for our time. So we need to be able to understand who are these powers. Who is this king of the north? Who is this king of the south? Well, they're part of, this is the longest prophecy or the longest vision in the Bible here in Daniel, Daniel chapter 11, and even Daniel chapter 10. Yes, starting in Daniel chapter 10 and verse 10. So it's part of a long prophecy. And you can go back to the start of the vision. It's talking about Alexander the Great and the leaders that came after him. And then at this point here in verse 40, it starts talking about the time of the end. And so much of the book of Daniel emphasizes that this book is written for this end time period. So there's two great powers that would clash in this time of the end, the king of the north and the king of the south, a northern power and a southern power, in a clash that revolves, that's all around the Middle East, that revolves around Jerusalem. You can see that in verse 41 that talks about the king of the north entering into the glorious land. So much of this clash revolves around Jerusalem. So who is this king of the south? Well, we do have a free book, The King of the South, that you can use to prove this in more detail. I'll go over some of that just briefly. But if you want to really prove this to yourself, I'd really encourage you to get that book, The King of the South, and you can read that online or order that at our website, thetrumpet.com. And of course, we have our phone number that you can call our operators on 1-866-930-3024. I'll give you that number a few times before the show ends. And of course, everything that we offer, everything that we have is completely free, including postage and everything, no follow-up, no selling your details on, no catches. We just want to get this material out there to you. But who is this king of the north? Who is this king of the south? Well, anciently, the power that was the king of the north was taken over by the Roman Empire. And then the Roman Empire is continually resurrected in Europe. So the king of the north is referring to a resurrected Holy Roman Empire in Europe, a European power. And the king of the south is its main enemy in this region, radical Islam, led by Iran, a power that is dominating all around this southern region. Now, Iran itself is north of Jerusalem, but so much of its influence is to the south of Jerusalem, and certainly it's all to the south of the king of the north. And so Iran and radical Islam led by Iran is going to play a critical role in end time events, and that makes them really important to watch. And they do tie in as well with U.S. politics. There's a chapter in Mr. Flurry's book, Great Again, chapter 6, The Most Dangerous Lie in History, that talks a lot about Iran and the Iran deal from President Obama. And if you look at the way the Obama administration and the Obama third term, really, under Biden now, supports Iran and builds up Iran, that exposes a whole lot about that administration. How much these people are really working against America, that they're able to work so closely and do so much to build up this enemy nation, this nation that chants death to America. You know, the Obama and the Biden, or really it is just the Obama administration, that they would get behind and empower such an obviously evil regime says a lot about them. But here they are in Daniel chapter 11, playing a critical role in end time Bible prophecy. And you can see them in this role already as king of this region, dominating this region, focusing radical Islam in this whole area, you're leading them and focusing them on conquering Jerusalem. The Australian Strategy Policy Institute's paper, The Strategist, they had a really good article on this at the end of last week called Iran's Role in the Latest Gaza Conflict. And it makes a fantastic point, just that really does underscore Iran's role as the king of the south, as the king of this region. And in this article, it talks about how you didn't see much in the media about Iran's role in the Gaza conflict. Not in the mainstream media, really. It was focused on Hamas. It was focused on Israel. They didn't really talk much about Iran. However, the strategist writes, the way the conflict was framed, both by the Gaza groups, they're talking about Hamas and Islamic Jihad, both by the Gaza groups and by Iran's broader regional network, from Hezbollah in Lebanon to the Houthis in Yemen, make it clear that they all view their regional battles as merely fronts in an integrated transnational jihad directed against Israel by Iran's Revolutionary Guards Corps. They're the leaders of radical Islam. They're the king of the south. They're the ones coordinating all of these different groups in different countries and directing them against Israel and against Jerusalem. This article quotes one Islamic Jihad official, Ramez al-Habadi, saying, the Mujahideen in Gaza and in Lebanon use Iranian weapons to strike the Zionists. We buy our weapons with Iranian money. An important part of our activities under the supervision of Iranian experts. The contours of the victories in Palestine as of late were outlined with the blood of Qassam Soleimani, Iranian blood. You know, they're out there, these terrorists in Israel and in Gaza, saying, we owe this all to Iran. We're able to do this because of Iran. It was the same for Hamas, their Gaza chief, Yahadi Sinwar. He said that his group's complete gratitude is extended to the Islamic Republic of Iran, which has spared us and the other Palestinian resistant factions nothing in recent years. They have provided us with money, weapons, and expertise. They have supported us in everything. They weren't with us on the ground, but they were with us through those capabilities. And now we see the Biden administration empowering Iran, really building Iran up, supporting them. What's that going to do to Israel and to Israel's security in the Middle East? You know, President Trump really helped Israel by confronting Iran, and now we're seeing you're seeing them being empowered. And then there's this article, I thought this was a really interesting point. It goes on to talk about the Houthis, this terrorist group that's in Yemen, fighting Saudi Arabia. And in theory, well, that should have nothing to do with Jerusalem and Israel. They exist to fight Saudis. They're an enemy of Iran in their own right, but they're fighting the Saudis in Yemen and they're backed by Iran. That conflict doesn't look like it's got much to do with Israel on the surface. But then you look at what the Houthis say, and they were like really... It looks like, based on media reports, when you had this Gaza conflict, they were quite keen to get in on it. Hamas maybe weren't as keen to let them, but they really wanted to get involved in this conflict. So the strategist, they quoted Al-Akbar, saying that the Houthis contacted Hamas to ask for coordinates inside Israel so that they could start targeting them with Yemeni missiles and drones. They wanted to start attacking them from Yemen. Basically, Hamas told them, you know, we're good, we're fine, we don't need your help. There was another report by a news magazine linked to the Iranian Revolutionary Guards Corps, Mashgreth News, that said that a Yemeni from the Houthi stronghold of Sada was killed in Gaza during the conflict, becoming, quote, the first Yemeni martyr in the fight against the Zionist enemy. So if that's to be believed, and again, that's not a reliable source and it's linked to the Guards Corps there, it could be propaganda, but if it's true... you've got Yemenis going and fighting and dying against Israel. They're attacking Israel. This strategist article writes, the Houthis, a long-standing Iranian proxy, view their war in Yemen as part of the regional IRGC jihad to destroy Israel. They're focusing on it as being a fight against Israel, not against Saudi Arabia. Hence their slogans, adapted from Iran's own, death to America, death to Israel. Curse on the Jews, victory to Islam. That's their slogan. And this is another group, terrorist group, that the Biden administration is trying to go easy on. That they're trying to tell Saudi Arabia, no, let them have fuel. Don't cut off their trade. And they're shouting death to Israel, or death to America, death to Israel. They even put death to America first. You know, one of their leaders said, the only path is the path to Jerusalem, the path of jihad against the Jews. And the Houthis, they recruit Yemenis to liberate the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Why is Iran focusing this group on Jerusalem? Well, this is all part of Iran being the king of the south, organizing all of these different powers against Israel, trying to capture Jerusalem. It talks about, well, this article goes on and talks about the way that you had rockets and drones being launched from all around Israel, from Lebanon, from Syria, maybe even from Iraq, by all of these different proxies. And it quotes another individual from Islamic Jihad saying, the axis between Jerusalem and Beirut, the axis between Jerusalem and Baghdad, the axis between Jerusalem and Damascus, the axis between Jerusalem and Sana'a, and first and foremost, the axis between Jerusalem and Tehran, it is a victorious axis. So Iran is at the center. There are all of these different axes, there are all of these different alliances, but Iran is at the center. And the Bible says that some of those alliances and things like that are going to shift in the years ahead. But it's clear that Iran is the king of this region. They're the king, the leader of radical Islam. And it's exactly the role the Bible describes as fighting them playing as the king of the south. And like I said, all this fighting in Daniel 11, it revolves around Jerusalem. And this scripture, you know, it has even more specific prophecies. Daniel 11 and verse 43, for example, it talks about the king of the north coming up and conquering Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia. So the king of the north goes to war with the king of the south, and in the course of that war, the king of the north conquers Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. So the implication is Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia, they're on the same side as the king of the south. That's why the king of the north invades them and conquers them. So watch these countries. That's a very specific prophecy that we can make because of the Bible, that these countries are going to end up aligned with Iran. You know, these are things that we've talked about for years. I mean, Mr. Flurry's talked about Iran being the king of the south for years and years, all the way back in, I think it was 91 or 1992, he had an article on will Iraq fall to Iran? And that's exactly what we've seen. And he was writing that, you know, he'd be the first to tell you, not because he was an expert in news analysis or anything like that. It was because he was basing a forecast on revealed truth, on Daniel chapter 11, on the Bible. And now, back then, there was much less on the surface or in terms of news events to really show that Iran was this king of the south. I think that there was definitely a lot of evidence. But now look how much we have. How much more? How much clearer is it that they are this king of the south? And then we're able to make these predictions that Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia, well, they're going to be allied with the king of the south. And I mean, we've talked about on the trumpet Ethiopia for years, and people would write in and say, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, Ethiopia is a stable Christian country. It would never be part of an Iranian alliance. You know, and now look at it. Ethiopia is falling apart. They've got elections coming up, and you know, people are writing articles. Well, what would happen if radical Islam takes over Ethiopia? This thing that at one point people said was just impossible. Now, I mean, it's a sad thing to see the country fall apart. There's a lot of suffering for people in Ethiopia that's been going on recently and that will go on as Iran continues to gain control of it. But the Bible says that it's going to happen, and it is going to happen. Now, God gives us all of this prophecy to point us to Him. And this prophecy and these events may involve some suffering, but at the same time, they show us God is in control of them. God is in charge of them. In his book, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, Mr. Flurry writes, we must see how God controls his master plan in a meticulous and detailed way. God the Father is in control of these events in a meticulous and detailed way. You know, he's involved in the events in this world. He's involved in having a plan for world events. And he's meticulous and detailed in how that unfolds. He'll get involved in your life in a meticulous and detailed way. These prophecies, these fulfilled prophecies, and there's so much fulfilled prophecy that we can see all around us. It points us to God the Father. And there's so much more that's happened already that can point you to Him. So there's a lot of benefit for us in understanding these prophecies. Iran, the fall of East Jerusalem. Well, the fall of all of Jerusalem, and then it talks about the king of the north getting involved and focusing on Jerusalem. And we'll talk more about that in just a couple of minutes. There's so much critical understanding here. And overall, you know, understanding these prophecies, understanding this fulfilled prophecy, and it all points you to God the Father and His plan for world events. So like I mentioned a few minutes ago, you can get all of this, you can read and study and prove for yourself what's going on in the Middle East in that book, The King of the South, which you can get from our website, thetrumpet.com. You can call in that number again is 1-866-930-3024. We'll be very happy to send you a free copy of that with no follow-up or obligation or anything like that. And if you want to get in touch with us about this or anything else, we have our email address as well, td@thetrumpet.com. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back.
The Trumpet Daily. The world is hopelessly confused about Bible history and prophecy. Understanding the Daniel 2 image could clear up most of that confusion. The Daniel 2 image gives an overview of history and prophecy like nothing else in the Bible. The Bible is a masterful work that should be studied in its entirety. The book of Daniel and the images described therein actually unlock the meaning of the prophecies in the book of Revelation. Our free booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, explains the incredible prophecies contained in these two books. Studied alongside your Bible, this booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, will bring the history and prophecy of your Bible to life. Request your free copy today. There is absolutely no cost or obligation. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And we've been talking in the first half about Iran and the King of the South. I want to shift gears now in this second half and talk about Europe and Germany and the King of the North. I'll start just with some quotes from an article that I saw last week. This is from the National Interest. The title of the article is Germany is a Bad Ally. And it's a very good article. It's pretty rare to see a worldly news article that will point this out. And it talks about mistakes the Biden administration is making with Germany. It says, simply put, Germany is neither a good ally, nor does its leadership share the same liberal democratic worldview as the United States. And it talks about the way that so many different German leaders have been working closely with Russia. It talks about the former German Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, who left office and went to join Gazprom and work for Vladimir Putin. And they say this National Interest article says, increasingly his career trajectory and cynicism may be the rule rather than the exception for German politics, as Russia and the money it offers encourages further Schröderization of German elites. They're signing up with Russia. It talks about Matthias Wornig, the Nord Stream 2 CEO, and this was, America had sanctions on this individual. He's a former Stasi agent, and Blinken and the Biden administration waived those sanctions. And he's a former Stasi agent with these close links to Putin, but Biden says, well, that's fine if we have these people in charge. It then also talks about the way that Germany is working closely with China. It says Germany increasingly allows China to utilize the port of Mukran. The base of operations for Nord Stream 2 construction is a key component of its Belt and Road scheme. It says Berlin has consistently allowed the promise of commercial contracts to undermine consensus with regard to Iran's nuclear program and Iran's horrendous abuse of human rights. It says that the leader of Germany's Green Party high-fived the Islamic Republic's ambassador, even as Iran arrested environmentalists and hanged homosexuals. So Germany sides with Russia against America, with China against America, with Iran against America. And it talks about how the way the Biden administration is working to try and build Germany up right now, to be an opponent to Russia, to China. And he's saying, well, you know, look at their behavior. They're not being an opponent to these countries. He says, Germany is the wrong country to trust to man the ramparts in the defense of threats against freedom. And it concludes, Biden and Blinken are right that the United States must address China's growing threat, But to trust Berlin or defer leadership to it essentially puts the fox in charge of the hen house. It is time to recognize that Germany is not a trustworthy or dependable ally. There are too few people pointing out and understanding, you know, Germany is not America's friend. The fruits are there. You know, this article is full of facts, but and people have looked back to this a NATO alliance that's lasted since World War II, that's lasted 70, 80 years, and they don't want to admit that, well, Germany's used that, taken advantage of it, and they're ready to move on now. They're growing to be a rival power. But I wanted to talk about one aspect of this, more for Europe as a whole, on a different news story that we've seen from the weekend. I think a really interesting one that has not gotten very much attention at all. And that is about a politician that the Catholic Church is in the process of making a saint. Now, why would the Catholic Church be making a politician a saint? This is not something that happens very often at all. The last time the Catholic Church canonized someone for political reasons, for political work that they did, it was Sir Thomas More. And if you think back, for those of you that know your history, that was quite a while ago. That was Sir Thomas More opposed Henry VIII's marriage to Anne Boleyn. So, and he was executed in 1535. So you have to go back 500 years to find an example of the Catholic Church making a politician a saint. But they're in the process of making, well, several politicians saints, but all for very similar reasons. But the latest news comes from Robert Schuman, the French Prime Minister after World War II, Foreign Minister, Finance Minister. And he's been put on the path to sainthood. On Saturday, the Pope published a decree recognizing his heroic virtues. And so the Pope approving this decree, recognizing his quote, heroic virtues, that means that Schuman now has the title Venerable, the Venerable Robert Schuman, I guess it would be according to the Catholic Church. And this is one of the earliest milestones in the process that could lead to canonization. Now they need to find two miracles. And once they find and confirm two miracles, I think one miracle, he gets to become the blessed, and then two miracles, and he's a saint. And these miracles, of course, for the Catholic Church, Catholic teaching, they can come posthumously. There are whole departments for looking into this. But why push this politician to become a saint, something, or at least on this process of becoming a saint, something the Catholic Church hasn't done in 500 years? Well, this whole process reminds us of something critical about the European Union. That this is something the Catholic Church is very enthusiastic about, something they helped build. And now Robert Schuman is one of the founding fathers of the European Union. And for that, him and several others of the founding fathers, many of them were Catholics, and many of them are now on the road at various different stages for the Catholic Church making them saints. So it's a reminder of something that a lot of people have forgotten, the very close relationship between the Catholic Church and the European Union. It used to be something that was better known. In 1962, the Topic magazine, which Topic has, I think, gone bust quite a long time ago, but they were a notable, prominent mainstream magazine at the time. And they wrote, the Vatican, usually cautious over political changes, not of its own inspiration, now considers the common market the work of divine providence. Not since the time of Spain's Charles V, has a Roman Catholic political force been so strongly wielded? Not since the end of the Holy Roman Empire has the Vatican been offered a Catholic rallying point like the common market. If the Pact of Rome, which created the common market, had been signed within the Vatican walls, it could not have favored the Church more. So they've worked hard on this project all along. There was an early report where the Vatican first started looking into the canonization process of several of Europe's so-called founding fathers, Schuman and then also Alessi di Gasperi and Konrad Adenauer, the report was called On the Eighth Day God Created Europe. It's a project that they're heavily involved in. And Adrian Hilton, he has a book, The Principality and Power of Europe, that talks about the origins of the European Union. And in that book, he writes, Europe's leaders and Roman Catholic Church are still working towards the common goal of unity. Many of Europe's political leaders see a crucial role for the Roman Catholic Church in their efforts, providing a powerful, cohesive, common religion to hold Europe together politically. He continues, since World War II, each pope has thrown his weight behind moves toward the creation of a supranatural European Union. Pope John XIII insisted that Roman Catholics should be in the front ranks of that unification effort. In 1963, Pope Paul VI declared, everyone knows the tragic history of our century. If there is a means of preventing this from happening again, it is the construction of a peaceful, organic, united Europe. In 1965, he said, a long, arduous path lies ahead. However, the Vatican hopes to see the day born when a new Europe will arise, rich with the fullness of its traditions. And another quote, Pope Paul VI, from Rome in 1975, he said, Can it not be said that it is faith, the Christian faith, the Catholic faith, that made Europe? It is, therefore, that our mission as bishops in Europe take on a gripping perspective. No other human force in Europe can render the service that is confided to us as promoters of the faith to reawaken Europe's Christian soul where its unity is rooted. That for Europe to unify, it needs this Christian background. And then, of course, during the 70s and 80s, after it had helped establish what would go on to become the European Union, the Vatican played a key role in drawing Eastern Europe, which was then ruled by the Soviets, into this European power. And Pope John Paul II, he was particularly instrumental in bringing Eastern Europe out of the tyranny of communism, but then into the European Union. And more people should be looking at this Catholic nature within Europe. And this article, like I said, this news event really does underscore that. And even setting the Bible to one side for a moment, if you just look back at history, there is a clear pattern there of the Catholic Church getting involved in politics. And you can go back as recently as World War II, and you've got Mussolini and Hitler signing critical agreements with the Catholic Church, gaining Catholic support for their rule, and in turn granting privileges to the Catholic Church. And you see the same thing with Napoleon. Before that, you see the Holy Roman Empire, and that article, the 1962 article from the Topic magazine, they hearkened all the way back to that. And they saw, well, not since the Holy Roman Empire have you had the Catholic Church getting so involved in politics. But this Holy Roman Empire, a system of leaders going back centuries where the Catholic Church worked hand in glove with secular kings, when bishops would be critical parts of civil administration. And so to see the Catholic Church again working to create a united European empire, well, that should cause people to sit up and take note. And then, as we read from that article at the start, it's a European empire led by Germany that is increasingly going in a different direction from the United States, that doesn't have the same values of supporting democracy and human rights, or opposing some of these abuses and slavery and things like that going on in China. It's going its own way. It's its own separate power. And the Catholic Church is there helping to build it up. And we have a free book on this subject too, the Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy. And the history in that book alone gives a powerful warning. And then you look at what the Bible says and you bring that in, and there's an even more specific, powerful warning. Revelation chapter 17, it talks about a woman riding a beast, an empire led by a church in biblical symbolism. And that chapter talks about this system, this empire led by a church, vanishing and then reappearing, dying and being resurrected. It's gone and then it comes back again. And this happens seven times in total. And we're seeing this same system coming back one last time. And that's why the Catholic Church canonizing a politician, canonizing Robert Schuman, or at least being in the process of that, is another important news event. They pushed for the creation of this European Union, and now they're reminding the world of that good Catholics support the European Union. And it's exactly what the Bible said, that you'd have this woman leading the beast power. And when you think about what we talked about in the first half, this clash going on and this clash revolving around Jerusalem. Well, why is the King of the North, why is this European power so concerned about Jerusalem? Well, a good deal of the answer to that has to do with this religious influence, has to do with this Catholic Church dominating the this power, this woman guiding the beast. And again, just like with Daniel 11, you can see so much Bible prophecy having been fulfilled already. I helped do some of the research for that Holy Roman Empire booklet. And the more you get into the details and into that history, the more you see just how in precisely and in meticulous detail those Bible prophecies have been fulfilled. And it's a great study, not just to learn history better, but to look at the authority and the inspiration of the Bible, to look at this prophecy that comes from God the Father. I mean, this book of Revelation, where so much of this prophecy comes from, you can see in Revelation 1 and verse 1, that comes directly from God the Father. And then you see it happening in exact detail throughout history. And you can know that all of these details that are forecast to happen here on out, they're certain. They're coming too. And it's just, it contains an overview of European history that matches so well with what we've seen before. So we see now Europe rising up as a rival to the United States, and as Mr. Obama, still Mr. Obama, but through kind of Mr. Biden, tearing things down, there's a rival coming, and the national interest sees that. But what these news events and what news articles like that national interest can't tell you is that this is all happening according to this plan laid out in the book of Revelation from God the Father 2,000 years ago. Now, he is still in control. And our book, The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy, will help prove that to you. And once again, you can get that book by going to our website, thetrumpet.com. You can give us a call on that number, 1-866-930-3024, and you can read it online. We'll be very happy to send you your own print copy so you can study it. And if you want to get in touch with us about that, anything else, once again, you can email us on td@thetrumpet.com. We'll take a quick break, and once more, we'll be right back.
Trumpet Daily. Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States.
Hoorah!
One in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening. And what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe, and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry. And I forgot to go over at the beginning all the places that you can get the show, and you can tune in on 101.3 on the FM dial and listen in on our website, kpcg.fm, but of course we do also have the video stream going on at thetrumpet.com. You can go there when the show is going, and you can watch it. You can also watch the show after it's been broadcast at the Trumpet Daily or at thetrumpet.com and tune in there. I have to thank our video guys for that trailer the promo that we got during the break. That really was the perfect promo for everything that we've been covering on this show today. Way to find something that matches exactly. We're talking about the King of the South, talking about the rise of this European power, So you've got a good recap of everything that we've been talking about over the last 45 minutes on there. Well, I wanted to conclude the last 10 minutes in a bit of a Bible study. I want to start with a question, though, that doesn't really sound like it's leading into a Bible study. Are you smarter than a slime mold? I don't think you are. Now, that's not that's not intended as an insult. Maybe it does sound insulting, I guess. But I don't think I am smarter than a slime mold either in certain ways on that question. But just last month I think it was published in May 20th, the London Review of Books had an article called From Its Myriad Tips. It was reviewing a book that someone had written on fungi. And it talks about how good fungi are at problem solving. And it says that fungi is very good at finding the most economical route between points of interest. The mycologist Lynn Bode once made a scale model of Britain out of soil, placing blocks of fungus-colonized woods at the points of the major cities. The blocks were sized proportionately to the places they represented. Mycelial networks quickly grew between the blocks. The web they created reproduced the patterns of the UK's motorways. Other researchers have set slime mold loose on tiny-scale models of Tokyo, with food placed at the major hubs. And in a single day, they reproduced the form of the subway system on maps of IKEA. And they found the exit more efficiently than the scientists who set the task. The scientists got beaten by the slime mold. Slime molds are so good at this kind of puzzle that researchers are now using them to plan urban transportation networks and fire escape routes for large buildings. So imagine that. The greatest scientists or the greatest computer programs that we can design and we can write, well, when it comes to solving certain problems, like finding the most efficient route between a series of destinations, fungi and slime mold solve it better than we do. And solve it better than our best computer programs do. A 2012 New York Times article looked at the way slime mold was able to design America's transportation network better than highway planners. And I think this is a fascinating subject in a whole number of different ways. But the first and probably the most obvious is, well, when you look at this, it really points to an incredible creator God. I think this is something you see in so many different areas. But if you look at the world through a kind of evolutionary perspective, well, when you look at some of these creatures that scientists say have been around on the world for millions or billions of years, well, we should be looking at things that are less evolved and therefore less sophisticated and more backwards. And I remember several years ago, I was just reading a book on dinosaurs because I loved dinosaurs when I was a kid. And I was just kind of curious how the science had changed and things like that. And it was really interesting. This book kind of pointed out that decades ago, scientists thought, okay, dinosaurs are millions of years old. Therefore, they're millions of years less evolved. So they're simpler, they're cruder than animals that are around today. And from what we can tell from fossils and things like that, that's absolutely not the case. And that whole thinking about dinosaurs has been completely rejected because from everything that we can tell, they're every bit as sophisticated and meticulously designed, or adapted as they would say, but meticulously designed as animals that are today. You know, in evolutionary terms, you should be able to find animals that are much simpler, less complicated, just worse, less perfect. But instead, everywhere you look, you see perfection. Even something as disgusting as slime mold, you see evidence of a great creator God, a real creative genius at work. There aren't these imperfections or less developed animals. You cannot fail to, or anywhere you look on earth, you will find something amazing. Anywhere. You know, we don't know how to solve these problems so well, but God can create a slime mold that can solve it better. And look at the attention to detail that God puts in every aspect of his creation. Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 10 says, "Whatsoever your hand finds to do, do it with your might." And is there a better, there isn't a better example of that than God. You know, he could have said, well, it's a slime mold, it's a fungus. We can cut a few corners with that one. We don't need to put a lot of attention or design into this. But he didn't. I wrote an article and did a program several years back on the amazing animals that you find at the bottom of the sea. And it's very hard to get there. It's only in recent years we've even been able to look there. And when we do, though, there's still all of these spectacularly engineered creations. Things that glow in the dark or adjust to tremendous pressures. And God could have said, well, forget the bottom of the sea. Who's going to see that? We don't really need to work hard down there. And, you know, it's really hard to get to. We can just leave that blank. But instead, we see perfection everywhere. And we can learn so much about God's mind from this kind of subject. And Romans chapter 1 talks about this and how about scientists should be able to see this, see more about God from this creation. But we can also learn about the human mind. You know, why is it that when it comes to certain types of problems, fungi or slime mold is smarter than we are? You know, if a slime mold can figure out how to plot routes between cities like this better than us, well, how come there isn't an animal out there that can figure out art or music? And you start to see more about this fundamental difference between the human brain and the animal brain. That it's not just about physical quality, that there are plenty of animals out there with bigger brains, and fungi don't even have brains, but they can solve some problems better than we can. You know, what is it that makes the human brain so much better than other brains if it's not simply just being better quality? Mr. Armstrong, Herbert W. Armstrong, in his book, The Incredible Human Potential, writes, actually, the brain of an elephant, a whale, or a dolphin is virtually equal in complexity, design, and quality, and larger in size than the human brain. The chimpanzee's is also virtually equal, but slightly smaller in size. Why, then, is the human mind so transcendentally superior to the animal brain? And 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 11 starts to give us the answer to this. That says, for what man knows the things of a man save the spirit of man which is in him? Even so, the things of God knows no man but the spirit of God. And this explains the difference. If you look for purely material differences, you can't find them. It's incredibly hard to see anything superior about the human brain, hence us getting beaten by slime mold when it comes to certain physical tasks. But then there's a spectacular, huge spiritual difference. There's a spirit there in the human mind that no fungi or slime mold or animal has. And so in the last few minutes, I'd like to point you to that book, The Incredible Human Potential. Now, God is working to create man in his image. He wants us to develop a mind as brilliant and creative as his. And so to do that, well, he's given us a human spirit. And then he wants to work with men to give them another spirit. The Holy Spirit, that they need to have a complete mind. And then with that, well, then man's potential is to develop godly character. In that book, The Incredible Human Potential, Mr. Armstrong writes, God first formed plant life, the flora. Next was matter reproducing itself, but without self-consciousness, without brain. Next, God created the fauna, animal life, in which he placed the brain with a certain consciousness, yet without the thinking, reasoning, decision-making process. But man, to be reproduced into the God family, was designed to have a godly-type mind, ability to think, reason, make choices and decisions, develop God-like character. So God gave us a different spirit, and because of that human spirit, well, then he can give man the Holy Spirit, that same spirit that he has. And he's working to reproduce himself in man, to create more minds that can go out and think and design the way that he can, the way that can create more spectacular creations, creatures, and fill the universe even with the same kind of creation that he has filled the earth with. So this explains why we're so different. This difference between us and the slime mold, even though the slime mold can beat us at certain tasks, it shows our incredible human potential. And there's a lot more to that potential. I'd really encourage you to read that free book, The Incredible Human Potential. You can get that on our website, thetrumpet.com. You can call us on 1-866-930-3024, and we would be very happy to hear from you on any of these subjects. You can email us at td@thetrumpet.com.